You're listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio. I'm J. Kyle Sullivan. The College Connection is a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers, given and recorded at the five colleges. This forum provides an opportunity for listeners to engage with the researchers, intellectuals, poets, and authors active within our academic communities. Chakravarti Ramprasad is professor of comparative religion and philosophy at Lancaster University in the United Kingdom. In this talk, Ramprasad examines an excerpt from the Mahabharata, a Sanskrit epic poem. In the poem, a female who has renounced the world in order to attain spiritual enlightenment challenges a king, who argues that real spiritual enlightenment is achieved only while still engaged in the normal duties of life. Ramprasad says this argument is as much about gender as it is spirituality, and the ancient text provides, quote, interesting contributions to contemporary debates about gender and feminist philosophy. Entitled Gender and Body Talk, a Philosophical Debate from Classical India, Ramprasad's lecture was recorded on April 13th, 2017, at Amherst College.
So within the famous large epic composition, the Mahabharata, which is almost considered a national epic of India, which is sort of twice as large as the Odyssey and the Iliad combined, we have not only a strong set of narrative elements, but also within the nested series of narratives in the text, particular episodes which are intrinsically valuable, even if they don't play a role in the larger text as a whole. One of these concerns the conversation between a woman who has renounced the world, who has, as it were, become an almswoman, a nun, called Sulabha, and her conversation with a king, Janaka. The reason I'm dealing with this episode, which is actually much less well-known than it deserves to be, is because although we don't know exactly who the authors or the composers of this large text were, we can generally assume that they were men. However, in many places, and this is an example of it, they show a remarkable sensitivity towards perspectives which are highly gendered. Sometimes they talk about issues in a very traditional, classical, cultural context, with remarkable sensitivity to how men as well as women see particular situations. In this story, what we have is, at one level, a clash between two perspectives about what the appropriate spiritual or religious life should be. And that is how it has been mostly received by the tradition. Sulabha and Janaka agree that the ideal mode of living is one in which a human being has attained a certain level of psychological detachment to the suffering as well as the triumphs, the joys as well as the pain of human existence. So they gain a level of detachment. Now, this detachment is supposed to have a deep consequence on the kind of person you are. So life continues to happen, you continue to have experiences, but your attitude to it gets fundamentally switched from responsiveness, from engaging, from wanting things or being afraid of things happening to you, to accepting things as they come and treating them all alike. This idea of equanimity or detachment from the conditions of life is an ancient and much lauded aspect of Hindu traditions and Buddhism and Jainism as well, all the classical religions of India. So Sulabha and Janaka agree basically that the highest spiritual attainment is this notion of detachment. However, there is a long-standing debate, of which this is an example, between those who say that in order to gain this extraordinarily rare psychological perspective, you must step out of the normal conditions of life which throw these good and bad things at you. So if you continue to have your ordinary job, your work, if you have a relationship, you have family, you have a social context in which you function, then you're constantly going to be swinging between disappointments and attainments, between joy and sorrow. So the renunciatory point of view says, if at all you're going to have a chance to attain this state of detachment, you must step out of your social order. You must renounce the world. You must cut your ties to the world. So you live deliberately on the margins of society. People respect you for this great attainment of yours. You get given the food and the basic clothing and shelter that people give you as recognition of your attainment, but you have no other ties. In that way, you have made a most, you've taken the first important step out of being hostage to the conditions of life. On the other side is an argument which says, no, that is in a way an easy way out. If you step out of life, and if everybody did that, what would happen to society? What would happen to social order? Who would be doing the things that sustain the world as a whole? The real attainment is to be detached even while you're carrying on with whatever social role you have. So you must be able to combine an engagement in the world in which you perform your duties, you continue to have your relationships, and yet when good things happen to you, when bad things happen to you, you're able to handle them in an equanimous way. So here we have on the one side Janaka, who's a king, who obviously represents a total commitment to a social and a political order. He's a leader. He's got responsibilities. People look up to him. He's got this rich life around him. Obviously, if he claimed that he had this level of detachment, then he represents this this householder point of view, this social order point of view. And Sulabha has given up the world. Therefore, she represents this renunciatory point of view, which says, in order to progress spiritually, you must cut your social ties. So seen in one way, that is what this debate is about, and it echoes many other debates that have happened in classical India. However, it is not an accident that in this very long and complex text, the view of the renouncer is given by a woman. So what I'm suggesting here is that we must look at Sulabha's point of view not just as a renouncer challenging the king as to whether he can really have this kind of detachment, but also of a woman challenging a perspective which is masculinist, which is driven by the patriarchal order that the king represents. So that is the consequences of seeing this dialogue from a gendered perspective actually allows us to see this text as giving us very interesting contributions to contemporary debates about gender, about feminist philosophy. Although the text itself, of course, which was composed perhaps 2,000 years ago, is innocent of any such awareness. But because in their sensitivity, in their literary techniques, in their philosophical range, these authors, the unknown composers of the Mahabharata, are articulating a point of view so sympathetic to this woman called Sulabha, we have the resources to think of this text as something that can be brought into a conversation about contemporary debates about how men and women ought to relate to each other, how we ought to see gender as playing a role in philosophical discourse. So the story begins by Sulabha having heard this story about Janaka, thinking, is it really true that there is a person who claims to have this spiritual attainment of detachment and yet continues to be in the midst of life? So she does something very strange, and although the magical aspect of it is simply part of the narrative, it gives us, as we will soon see, a philosophically interesting move. We don't know what she looked like, whether she was young, she was old, but she has this power to change her form. And she very deliberately takes on this beautiful, the form of a beautiful young woman. So we don't know whether she was already young or old, whether she was already beautiful or not, but she presents herself in this way. She does not take on the form of what you might think of as a normal renouncer in that society, which would be maybe an old man. She deliberately remains a young woman, and she deliberately takes on this beautiful form. She goes to see the king. Now, when the king has seen her, he thinks to himself a question that he's soon going to ask her. And the way he puts the question already shows us what the problem is with Janaka, King Janaka's perspective. When the king saw her extreme delicacy and her beauty, he was overcome with amazement. Who is she? Whose is she? Where has she come from? He said to himself. But the normal rules are that if a renouncer shows up because they have done something very difficult, most people wouldn't do it, the king has to receive such a person with respect, so he does so. Now, Sulabha does something now, the second magical thing, very, very interesting step. Not only has she changed her form so that she can sort of make Janaka ask himself this question about who she is and whose she is, she does something different now. And it is rather mysterious as to exactly what she does, but let's try and understand it. Just as the king was about to address her, she fused the rays of his eyes to the rays of her own two eyes and bound him with the bonds of her yoga power. Janaka, the highest of kings, merely smiled. Then they began to speak. So there is something that's happening here. He looks at her because, of course, he's gazing at somebody who is beautiful, and that is from time immemorial, the classic view of what the masculine perspective is. That is, you look at a woman, you gaze, you subject her to this gaze. But what does she do? She does not simply accept it, is not demure, downcast, nor does she even just challenge him by gazing back at her. She does something even more dramatic. She uses her magical powers, and somehow some aspect of her being fuses into his range of awareness. Now, we don't, again, need to go too deeply into what exactly this could be, but what it represents is, right from the beginning, she has taken initiative. She has shown her agency. She has moved into this kind of suprasensory domain in which she is able to occupy a part of his own existence, his own being. In this sort of extraordinary conversation, presumably happening in silence, you just see two people gazing into each other's eyes, but the conversation is happening in this kind of suprasensory realm. Janaka asks the kind of questions that he has been thinking about right from when he saw her first. So he repeats to himself, to her again, "Where have your homeless wanderings taken you, blessed woman? And where will you go? Whose are you? Who do you belong to? That is, whose daughter? Whose wife? Where are you from? I cannot quite grasp the real state of affairs concerning your learning or your age or the social group. So give me these answers." And then he goes on to make this claim. "Look, I stand on the highest step of spiritual attainment." And he gives this very macho version of what it means to be detached. "He who smears sandal paste on my right arm and he who hacks off my left with an axe are both the same to me." So he chooses this very martial metaphor to show how detached he is, and perhaps undermining his own claims because it is so infused with his own pride. So he says, I remain a king, but I am superior to people like you who are mere renouncers. I have given up all these things. So he says, you know, these people who put on these ochre-colored robes, which is what these renouncers do, shaving off their head, all of these kind of things are accoutrements of people like you. I don't think it makes any difference. The real attainment is the one I have had, which is I have given things up. I have become detached. All the things that happened to me, that as a king happened to me, I am able to treat with supreme detachment. Now, having made that claim, he goes back to attacking her. He says, there's something wrong with your appearance. I will speak. Listen to me. Your delicacy and your form, your preeminent beauty and your youth, you have all of these and you're an ascetic too? I wonder, why did you make entrance into my country and into my city? Why have you come here? So he starts then challenging her on all of these things. And then he says, if your husband is alive, or even if he has left home for somewhere, there is a you've made an error because you have become, by becoming one with somehow my being, you're in effect having some kind of a sexual relationship with me, and that you're making me flout the rule by which I abide, which is one should not go into another's wife. So what has happened to your husband? What will he think that now that you have somehow possessed me? Or maybe you are on your own, free of a husband through some fault of your own. If you have any learning, it has all been made useless. And he then ends by saying, you give every indication of being a wicked woman there. What needs to be said has been brought to light. So he questions where she could be from. How could she be somebody who, if she were married, was allowed by her husband to become this ascetic? Or if the husband was somehow driven away by her, more fool she. And in any case, regardless of whether there was a husband or not, and regardless of whether she was married or not, he interprets what she has done with this magical powers of hers in a purely sexual way and says, you are a wicked woman. You're wandering on your own, and you do these things. So he cannot see beyond her form, and he cannot see beyond his interpretation of what she has done. So it is a very sort of an absolute summary of all the patriarchal, misogynistic things that a man might say about a woman whose attainments he is not able to understand and with which he cannot reconcile himself. And the text makes it very clear that it supports her point of view, because the narrator of the story says, having heard this inappropriate speech on the king's part, Suliba responds very calmly and without any either anger or fear. Then she begins a series of arguments, each of which I think has got something to say about debates that are being conducted to this day in the contemporary academy and in terms of the debates over gender. In the narrative itself, it sounds a little bit odd, because here she has heard all these accusations from him. She doesn't immediately respond to his questions. She steps back from it metaphorically and instead launches into this description of how one must speak and how one must argue. So he says there must be, you know, the way one speaks in a debate must be free of these 18 faults of rhetoric that spoil words of thought, and there must be a careful description in terms of sentences, words, meanings. So logically, syntactically, there must be a proper sequence. Rhetorically, this is how one must debate and argue. And then she goes on to describe how it will be and says, watch, and you will see that my speech combines all of these questions of things like sophistication and discrimination, clear order, the presentation of a conclusion, the clarification of the motivation with which one speaks. Now, it is very interesting from a contemporary point of view that Sulabha takes care to first frame what she is going to say with a description of how these things should be said. I shall say nothing whatsoever out of love, anger, fear, greed, desperation, vulgarity, shame, pity, or haughtiness. King, my speech will have this kind of meaning, and it will exhibit the full perfection of speech. You ought to listen with your mind undistracted and focused on this alone. So she immediately takes the high ground of rational discourse. This is very interesting, because in the history of Western thought, there has long been an assumption that only men think clearly, that rationality is the domain of the male philosopher or the male ruler. And one of the contemporary discourses has been over exactly what the status of this claim is. Broadly, you have two kinds of feminist responses to this. One which has become, in a way, perhaps very compelling in the last 30 or 40 years, has been to say that the entire history of the philosophy of rational thought about logic, about linguistics, about how argument is structured, how debates are conducted, mostly been conducted by men, been determined by men. So when men say, this is what rationality is, they are in fact building up a particular highly masculinist way of talking about how human beings function. And therefore, they are the entire tradition has been insensitive to how there might be reasoning, how there might be engagement between human beings, which are historically the realm of women, but which have been cut out of the whole narrative of logical reasoning and norms. So there is a different way in which women have thought, which has been cut out of the picture of philosophy. The other kind of argument says, no, that's not true. Actually, the problem has not been with the norms of reasoning. Men and women argue and can argue in the appropriate circumstances in exactly the same way. So the demands on reasoning, the demands on clear speech, the demands on rigorous argumentation are simply human capacities. The reason they have been associated with men is nothing to do with the intrinsic features of rational norms. It's really to do with the fact that the institutions of argument, whether it's a contemporary university or whether it is a parliament or other forms of political platforms, going all the way back to Plato's Academy in ancient Greece, it's because these institutions have been run by men for men. But that's not anything to do with rational norms. Sulabha is a clear exponent of the second way of reasoning. What she is saying, second way of looking at reasoning. So what she says actually is deliberately to point out, actually you are the one who's speaking out of pride, out of fear, out of vulgarity. I will tell you how one should in fact reason. So not only is there a rhetorical device by which she says, actually, the man in this is the one who's failing to have the rational norms. That's why she needs to teach him how to think. But she also absolutely, or the composers of this text, absolutely assert that rational norms are ungendered. How they are used and the context in which they are used, yes, they are gendered by how patriarchy functions, how men have traditionally had the power to determine where and how people speak. But the norms themselves, she says, are perfectly capable of being expressed by women. And she says that is not a matter for gender. So there is both the philosophical perspective on rational norms as well as the rhetorical device of pointing out that it is she who exemplifies it, not the king who is the exemplar of patriarchy. Her next argument is another very interesting one, because again, it has it has a bearing on controversies in contemporary debates in feminist philosophy. She says, King, you address me with a question, who are you, whose are you, where do you come from? And obviously what he's asking about is the social context. You know, who's your father that he's allowed you to walk away like this? Who's this husband who has either abandoned you or whom you have abandoned, etc.? She completely ignores that and instead says something in a way beside the point, but also making a deeper point. She says, when you ask who am I, I'll tell you who I am. I am a human being. This is how human beings are born. And she moves into giving this answer. Sound, touch, taste, form, odor, the five senses, these are the 10 entities that merge together like lacquer and wood and form an entity. It has been determined that there is no commanding of these things, there is no awareness of in any single one of those of itself or of anything beyond itself. And then she goes on to talk about the eye, the visible form, the causes, the intellect, the mind, the knower. Then you start realizing, so she is taking this idea of who are you, not at all in the social sense in which the king was asking a rather vulgar question, but responding as if this is a high philosophical discussion about who are human beings, how are we constituted, how are we formed, and she gives him a particular kind of philosophical account. Again, the details of the philosophical account are themselves very, very interesting. But for my purposes, I don't want to go into those details. What I want to just draw attention to is that she shifts the entire register of the question into an abstract philosophical discourse about the nature of the human being. In talking about the nature of the human being, she not only gives a metaphysics, you know, what is the mind, what is the intellect, how do they function? She also says something very interesting about what we might call ontogenesis, that is, how does the human being, the actual human being, develop as a fetus? And there we have a very interesting idea. She describes what 2,000 years ago was known to ancient Indian medicine about the stages of embryonic development. She says, well, who we are is, you know, the way the embryo develops as a fetus and is born. And that is the body. And there she says something, of course, which is, you know, scientifically not accurate, but it has something very interesting and important to contribute. She says, O king, when the ninth month has been completed in the development of the fetus, this particular person, the one who has the name and form, is produced male or female according to the sex mark. So what she says is that whether you're a man or a woman or whatever the sex properties are on the basis of which gender is determined, well, yes, it does happen, but it is just one of the many different things that are part of the development of what is the tradition calls the body. This has got a bearing on a contemporary debate about what is the relationship between gender and sex. That is to say, if there is a fluidity about how people take themselves to be men or women or other kinds of intergendered states, what do you do about the apparent givenness of the sex marks? Do they matter? Do they play a role? Can we deny it? After all, there seem to be some kind of structuration of the human body. She gets around this not by setting up a relationship, into determining one or the other side and saying, well, actually, sex properties matter. That's what determines gender, which is one very kind of regressive and restrictive way of thinking about gender. Or the other, which says, actually, it is completely misguided and wrong to think about sex properties at all. The biological should not play any role in gender. She takes a different line, which is to say, basically, when you're talking about a human being, there are a lot of things to talk about. How we develop, how our sensory capacities come to be, how what we take to be the bodily nature of our existence is very complex. One of the contingent features of that is the sex property. So I'm not saying that it isn't the case that I'm a woman and you're a man, but that I'm a woman and you're a man is just one little thing about all the other things which have to do with how human beings come to be. All people perpetually come into being in this fashion, she says, like a fine horse running swiftly. So who are they? Where do they come from? Where do they not come from? Who is this? Who is it not? Where does this come from? Where does that not come from? What is the connection? She says, these are all huge philosophical questions, and that's what you are asking. So she completely wrongfoots him by stepping around the kind of vulgar questioning, as I said, that he wants to ask of her, and instead gives this very substantial and sophisticated argument, which is in fact seldom made in the contemporary literature, which is to assimilate the biological dimensions into a larger narrative of what it is to be a human being by saying, look, it's contingent. I'm not saying it is necessary. I'm not denying it is there. I'm saying it's a contingent feature of the larger account of what human beings are. As far as I can tell, that's one of the. It's an argument about the relationship between the question of sex and gender, which is seldom made in even the contemporary literature, and therefore it's worth looking at. Then she turns to her own sort of criticism of the king. And here again, what she says has remarkable pertinacity to contemporary debates and in the history of the feminist understanding and exposition of especially modern Western thought. One of the features of the development of Western philosophy that has been critiqued and that feminist philosophers have made us understand is the systematic way in which just as rationality was thought to be, was claimed to be, and sometimes even now is claimed to be a unique capacity that men have that women don't have or can only aspire to or have an imperfect version of, you also have this larger accounting of the nature of men and women as a relationship between the transcendental, abstract capacity of men, which is encapsulated in the history of philosophy and the development of philosophical understanding, and the intuitive, earthy, immanent quality of women, which makes them the object of such understanding. And in fact, in classical Indian thought too, there is such an attitude. And actually, we would, if we had more time, we could see how Sulabha's account that we have just seen is an oblique criticism of this ancient Indian view. But certainly, there is a history, especially of early modern Western thought, in which there is an association, a gendered association of women with immanence, with engagement, with the material nature of the world, and of men with abstraction, with transcendence, the capacity to reason, to be the seer of the object that is the woman. And there is a long history which has been, of course, superbly criticized by several very important 20th century feminist thinkers, albeit it still remains tenacious and persistent in many cultures today. What is interesting here is that Sulabha does not simply challenge it or deny it. From her viewpoint as a renouncer, she in fact inverts it. And she says, you know, you, the king, you are the exemplar of the masculinist order, because the king is the supreme example of what men take themselves to be, which is rulers of the world. You, in fact, is the one who represents a boundedness to this world, an immanence in the ordinary order of things. As she says, the king is always dependent upon others. He himself attends to just a small part of things. How could the king be independent, completely in control? The king who rules this whole earth under a single imperial parasol dwells in just one city, and in this city he stays in just one palace, or in the case of some people we can think about, perhaps two places, where he lies upon just one bed at night, and he rests in that bed, and half of it belongs to his wife. Thus he is joined to the consequences of action by others through attachment. He's never completely in control, even when spending time in play with his wives. He's said to be in control when he commands others, but even there he is made to act without being in control as he attends to this or that detail. He's not in charge. Others are always telling him what to do: bathe, take hold, drink, eat, speak, listen. He's not freed from the mental torments that arise from desire, aversion, and kindness, nor from the diseases that fall upon one. He's beset by all these pairs of opposites, fearful on every side. He sees his kingdom plagued with many enemies and lies awake counting through the nights, tweeting. Oh, sorry, no, that's not part of the text. So what she does is that she takes this sort of dominant narrative of the masculinist vision of transcendence and power and says, the more power you think you have, the more bound and attached to the world you are. The more you think you command others, the more you are tied to them. So this entire narrative of power seeking is in fact powerlessness. The more you seek to control the world, the more you are controlled by it. If that is what you mean by being a king, the exemplary male, then you have demonstrated in fact that you are completely immanent in this world. So what she says, therefore, is that look at the contrast between you, who represents the immanence, and who I am. So here is where the two dimensions of this conversation, the one about the relationship between the contrast and contest between the renunciatory order and the political social order, and between the woman and the man, runs together. Because while she's talking about how the one who seeks to have this psychological state of detachment cannot do so when bound by the world, the example of who is like that is in fact the most powerful man imaginable, which is the leader, the king. She, on the other hand, is this woman. She then contrasts and finally contrasts her own position and finally starts in her own way answering his questions, but not as he would want them. She says that the very fact that he asked her those questions shows that he, in fact, had not gained that level of detachment. If you are completely free, that is to say you have become detached from these pleasures and pains of life, what wrong did I do to you when I made entry into you with my spiritual being? There is a special stricture in the rules for ascetics. They must dwell in an empty house without possessions. What violation did I commit, as you imply I did, and to whom, when I came to stay in this empty house, you? I'm not touching you, king, not with my hands, nor my arms, nor my feet, nor my legs, nor any other part of my body. A far-sighted man from a good family who has a sense of shame should not say such a thing in public. Whether it be true or false, it occurred between the two of us alone. You should not mention such a joining of man and woman in public. My goodness, the resonances are just so unbelievable. So what she is saying, therefore, is by the very fact that you questioned me, you have shown already, you have demonstrated that you cannot be detached, because you are thinking of my magical sort of relationship with you when I came into your being to converse with you as if it were sexual. You are attached to this way of looking at things. If you were truly detached, it would not matter to you that I was conversing with you in this way. It does not matter to me, because I truly am detached. So what she says is that there is, in their very interaction, he has demonstrated the failure to be detached, but he has also demonstrated a particular highly patriarchal reading of the only way in which he can conceive that a woman could have a relationship with him. Whereas she, by being a true renouncer, shows that it is possible for gender not to matter when it comes to spiritual attainment. And then he goes on to, she finally goes on to give these answers. He said, "Who you asked me who I was?" She says, "Well, actually, I was born to this king called Pradhana." He says, "Obviously, you've heard of him." So what she means is, you can't get me by saying I have no rootedness in the social order you recognize. I come from that. I'm the daughter of a king. And then she says something very powerful, and the very mysterious way in which she says it and the limited information she gives us is itself very powerful. "Since there was no husband suitable for me, I was trained in the rules for the spiritual discipline of gaining absolute freedom. So all alone I live according to the hermit way of life." She says, no husband was suitable for me. What exactly does that mean? Did her father try and not find it? Did she decide not to do so? Was there some kind of implicit demand on what a husband should be like that nobody could meet when it came to her? We don't know. All it does imply is that I could have been married, I chose not to. It's my agency that has brought me to this place. Now, this is very interesting. Of course, the normal way of the ancient world would be that the man would marry, the woman would marry. But when the man chooses not to marry and becomes a renouncer because he is undertaking this path, it is seen as something natural. So if a male renouncer had turned up to talk to the king, he would not have asked him, "Who are you? Whose are you?" And this is kind of thing that that echoes something that Simone de Beauvoir said in the mid-20th century. She says, when I begin to talk, I say that I am a woman. A man never begins by saying he's a man. Why is that? What she wants to do is to get at this very particular issue, which is that it ought not to be the case that men don't need to say that they speak as a man, but a woman does. Or it ought to be the case that whoever speaks says, "I speak as a man," or "I speak as a woman," and acknowledge the limited nature of their perspective. But in this world, it is the woman who has to say, "I'm speaking it." Now, could she not say that? Should she not say that? Well, up to a point, yes. She ought to try and say, what men do, so can women. Either both men and women, or neither men and women need to say this. But she does not feel that that is the right way to proceed, because the social reality is that she is made to say, "I'm a woman," when she begins to speak as a philosopher. So she wants to negotiate between an ideal in which there is equality, or there is some idea that gender ought not to matter, that it is simply something that happens to each individual equally, or It is the case that we must acknowledge a social reality, and we must acknowledge that there is a difference, that all over the world, that is the double standard that operates, and that must be recognized. So there is a particular idea of equality and a particular idea of difference. And my argument here is that this is what Sulabha is trying to do. She wants to say there is an idea of equality. When we are talking about how this supreme spiritual state of psychological detachment is to be attained, I am speaking for human beings. My capacity to have renounced and to have these powers and to be truly detached are, on the one hand, things that any man would have attained and you would not have questioned it. I chose that life and I have attained it. But at the same time, she's also saying, well, you would not have asked a man, whose are you? But you would ask of a woman. I have to tell you that no husband was suitable for me. You would not have asked a man whether a wife was suitable for him. You'd have assumed that he had the agency to have decided it. So do I. But I have to tell you this. So I want a certain idea of equality, and I'm teaching something that is for all human beings. And at the same time, I know that I have to say something specific about myself, because that is how the world operates, and I have to come out of that recognition of difference. So she ends with saying that I hold firm to my own lawful duty, I do not waver in my promises, I do not speak without careful examination. She says, as a mendicant might dwell for one night in an empty house in a city, so have I spent this night in this body of yours. So look at this as the presence of a true renouncer in your being. Do not think of this as a woman somehow being in a man. By gendering this relationship between us, you're losing sight of what it is that is important about my attainment. And this episode ends with the unequivocal statement of the composers of the text supporting what Sulabha has said. After he heard these reasoned and significant statements, the king did not say anything further. So it is a triumph of the perspective that Sulabha represents. Now, the easy way out of this is obviously to say, well, what the text is doing is to say the renouncer is the only true spiritual master, not the householder, not somebody caught up in the socio-political order of things. But we should take much more seriously, and that is what I'm arguing, that the victor in this case is a woman who has simultaneously said something that applies to all men, women. Whatever gender people take, the idea of psychological detachment as a spiritual ideal is taught by Sulabha. So at that point, it does not matter what the gender of this the teacher is, of the person who has attained it. But at the same time, she has acknowledged the real structural positioning from which the gender of the woman has not escaped, because already the masculine order has asked that question of her. It's the negotiation between this idea of equality and the idea of difference that is exemplified by Sulabha. It is not a resolution, and it's not a resolution we have had to this day, as we well know. Thank you.
That was Chakravarti Ramprasad, Professor of Comparative Religion and Philosophy at Lancaster University in the United Kingdom. You've been listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio, a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. You can find more College Connection online at nepr.net or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. For New England Public Radio, I'm J. Kyle Sullivan. Thanks for listening.